The inventor further speculated that the streams are formed of matter in some primary or elementary condition. Similar streams must be emitted by the sun and probably by other sources of radiant energy. Tesla also appeared to have come close to the idea of breaking up the electron into subatomic particles. The projected lumps of matter act as inelastic bodies, similarly to ever so many small lead bullets. These lumps are shattered into fragments so small as to make them lose entirely some physical properties possessed before the impact. Might it not be possible that in the Röntgen phenomena we may witness a transformation of ordinary matter into ether? Or we may be confronted with a dissolution of matter into some unknown primary form, the Akasha of the old Vedas. The inventor as physicist then proceeded to take X-rays of small animals such as birds and rabbits, as well as his workers and of his own skull, ribs, limbs, and vertebrae. As some shadowgraphs took as long as an hour to obtain, Tesla noticed that he would sometimes fall asleep while he was being bombarded by the machine. Week after week, Tesla would crank out yet another article on his latest results. On March the 18th, 1896, he announced in Electrical Review that he had produced shadowgraphs of humans at distances of 40 feet and affected photosensitive paper at a distance of 60 feet from the source of the rays. The inventor also tested different metals to see which ones reflected the energy in the best way. Adorned with a lavish X-ray of the bones of the wizard's own ribcage, the article conveyed an eerie impression. "I told some friends," Tesla wrote, "that it might be possible to observe by the aid of a screen objects and skeletons passing through a street. I mention this odd idea only as an illustration of how these scientific developments may even affect our morals and customs. Perhaps we shall shortly get used to this state of things." For Tesla, Röntgen rays were a gateway to a world invisible and ripe for new possibilities. "Röntgen gave us a wonderful gun to fire. Projecting missiles of a thousandfold greater penetrative power than that of a cannonball, and carrying them probably to distances of many miles. These missiles are so small that we may fire them through our tissues for days, weeks, and years, apparently without hurtful consequence." Throughout the year, the inventor suffered from the grip. Although his illness made the papers, nobody seemed to link it to his excessive experimentation with the mysterious energy. In fact, concerning the risk to one's health, Tesla wrote, "No experimenter need be deterred from investigation of Röntgen rays for fear of poisonous or generally deleterious action, for it seems reasonable to conclude that it would take centuries to accumulate enough of such matter to interfere seriously with the process of life of a person." We now know, of course, that this view is wrong, as long-term exposure to X-rays can be very dangerous to one's health. Tesla did, however, refer to pain in the center of his forehead when experimenting with the rays, and to the hurtful action on the skin, inflammation and blistering. But this he attributed to the production of ozone, which in small quantities was a most beneficial disinfectant. Nevertheless, there was a severe accident in the lab to a clear and zealous assistant without a protective screen present. The worker suffered severe blistering and raw flesh exposed. The inventor, undertaking the bitter duty of recording the accident in order to lessen the danger for others. Edison was also making headlines with his work with Röntgen rays, especially when he noted that the streams caused blind people to experience sensations in their eyes. The X-rays succeeded in eliciting from the blind the ejaculation, "I see, yes, I see a light." Edison, whose fluoroscope was already being used for lighting the eye during eye surgery, saw the possibility that eyesight, in some way, might be restored with the use of X-rays. Tesla doubted it, and so the press took up the charge and created a new round of headlines, placing the two pioneers once again against each other. The humorless dark Hungarian had the unpleasant duty to say, "Is it not cruel to raise such hopes when there is so little ground for it? What possible good can result?" Time proved Edison wrong, as X-rays have not been used to stimulate the retina in such a way as to restore sight. But the two wizards did perform a number of successful miracles with the strange energy when each used the instruments to locate bullets lodged in the bones of various patients. Fortunately, the Kentucky School of Medicine helped bring the battle between the two to a close when they combined the devices of Tesla and Edison to extract birdshot from the wounded foot of a voter who had received the injury in a fight at an election poll. After developing the X-ray, which took only 90 seconds to make, every bone was distinctly shown, and the shot, about 30 in number, were plainly located. To celebrate the triumph and quell any purported hostilities, T.C. Martin was able to coax Tesla into joining Edison and a number of other electricians for a day of fishing on a topsail schooner off Sandy Hook. The event was sponsored by the Safety Insulated Wire and Cable Company. Although a storm erupted, accompanied by dark clouds and lightning, the bold fishermen were undismayed. In stately grandness, as happy and well-satisfied a party as ever rode the waves of the Atlantic's billows. Toward nightfall, the ship turned her prow homeward. Nikola Tesla caught a flounder of large dimensions, and Edison caught a shocking big fluke. 20. Fall Speech, 1897. Nikola Tesla said much in a notable speech at the banquet to celebrate the conveyance of power from Niagara to Buffalo. Not just a plodding workman, he is a dreamer of wise dreams, a poet and a humanitarian working with new tools for the benefit of all. He is a man who wonders at the folly of men who invent guns when they might invent tools. His spirit is naturally hopeful. He looks not so much at the world as at the universe. He finds power in the waterfall and at the same time looks forward to a time when we may, perhaps, tap the unseen forces of the planets and use the cosmic energy that swings the stars in their courses. He looks to a time when power shall be so cheap, so universal, that all labor shall be done by tireless machines and every man's life be thus so much more worth living. Charles Barnard. In July 1896, Tesla journeyed to Niagara Falls for his first survey of this great enterprise. He traveled with George Westinghouse, Edward Dean Adams, William Rankin, and Commander George Melville of the U.S. Navy. Also present was Thomas Ely, supervisor of motive power for the Pennsylvania Railroad. Tesla was important to all five for almost as many reasons. A reporter for the Niagara Gazette greeted them upon their arrival. "Tesla is an idealist," the journalist wrote, "fully 6 feet tall, very dark of complexion, nervous and wiry. Impressionable maidens would fall in love with him at first sight, but he has no time to think of impressionable maidens. In fact, he is given as his opinion that inventors should never marry. Day and night he is working away at some deep problems that fascinate him, and anyone that talks with him for only a few minutes will get the impression that science is his only mistress, and that he cares more for her than for money and fame." Rankin predicted that Buffalo would receive electrical power by November, and Westinghouse predicted the costs would be cheaper than steam. "You could say it will cost one half what steam power costs," Rankin added in support. "Mr. Tesla, what is your opinion of the effect of this development of power on Buffalo and Niagara Falls?" "The effect will be that both cities will stretch out their arms until they meet." Tesla looked up at the roaring cataract overcome with emotion as he and the others donned their rain gear before entering the mighty wonder. He had grown up just 50 miles from the magnificent maze of cascading flumes known as Plivitza Lakes, but those were Lilliputian compared to this thundering colossus. Pride overcame the inventor as he trailed behind for a few moments to think, as he so often did, of his mountain homeland. It had been 4 years since he had seen his family, 15 years since his first successful construction of a turbine that could be driven by water power, and nearly 35 years since he had told his uncle of his dream of one day harnessing Niagara Falls. Humbled by this awesome manifestation of nature, he sat for a moment to reflect as he watched his cohorts disappear along the catwalks into a mist of rainbows. "Let's go, Mr. Tesla," Adams called out, having waited as patiently as he could, for the next stop on the itinerary was the Edward Dean Adams Hydroelectric Power Station, the first of two that would be built in his name. Designed by Stanford White, the edifice housed nearly a dozen gargantuan Tesla turbines, capable of generating collectively over 35,000 kilowatts. The men appeared like dwarfs, sauntering amid a lustrous gadgetry assembled as if by giants, one long row of towering kettle-shaped engines. From this chamber, an efficient, non-polluting, never-ending source of electrical energy was about to be generated, capable of driving the factories and illuminating the streets and homes of nearly one-fourth of the entire continent. The echoes of their steps faded as they stood for a moment in silence in the chapel of the dawning new age. Upon his return to New York, Tesla found a letter from Sir William Preece. A young man, half British on his mother's side and half Italian, had stopped by Preece's office with a wireless Morse code apparatus based on the work of Heinrich Hertz. Guglielmo Marconi, just 22 years old, had brought a notebook which reviewed the literature in the field, most likely the writings of Hertz, Large, and Tesla. Marconi had chosen wisely, as Preece was head of the British Post Office and had experimented himself in testing induction effects through the ground from telegraph lines. After the experiments with the classical Hertz devices under the auspices of the Imperial Post Office in England, Tesla reported many years later, Preece wrote me a letter conveying the information that the tests had been abandoned as of no value, but he believed good results would be possible by my system. In reply, I offered to prepare two sets for trial and asked him to give me the technical particulars necessary to the design. Just then, Marconi came out with the emphatic assertion that he had tried out my apparatus and that it did not work. Evidently he succeeded in his purpose, for nothing was done in regard to my proposal. Tesla's first patent, specifically for wireless transmission, was filed a year later on September the 2nd, 1897, number 650,353. The following month, in August 1896, Tesla received a histrionic plea from Catherine, who was vacationing with her family at a cottage in Bar Harbor, Maine. Wanting desperately for Tesla to join them, she could only allude to her wish. August the 6th, 1896. Dear Mr. Tesla, I am so troubled about you. I hear you are ill. Leave work for a while. I am haunted by the fear that you may succumb to the heat. Find a cool climate. Do not stay in New York. That would mean the laboratory every day. You are making a mistake, my dear friend, almost a fatal one. You think you do not need change and rest. You are so tired, you do not know what you need. If somebody would only pick you up and carry you bodily. I hardly know what to expect again by writing you. My words have no effect, forgotten as soon as read, perhaps. But I must speak, and I will. You do not send me a line? How delighted I should be if it bore an unfamiliar postmark. Sincerely yours, Catherine Johnson. Robert, having some perspective on Catherine's sense of drama, also wrote to invite him up. But I know it isn't safe for you to get more than 3 miles away from Delmonico's. The rumor is that you have melted in your laboratory. Perhaps Catherine was right, for Tesla was unavailable to the Johnsons even upon their return. Tesla was also ignoring letters from his sisters from Croatia, particularly Maritza, who, much like Catherine, asked him why he would not respond. Röntgen rays had been left behind many months ago, but he was still gaunt from illness and overwork. Now he was in a wireless race against newcomers like Marconi. Fearing that his invention would be pirated, Tesla's lab became a more mysterious place. November 7th, 1896. Dear Mr. Tesla, it may seem presumptuous for a stranger to address you, but Mrs. Johnson, my wife, whom you may remember having met, cannot refrain from uniting with me in congratulating you on the success of the Buffalo experiment. If this seems taking too great a liberty with one whom we know so slightly, I trust you will attribute it to our interest in the progress of humanity. Respectfully yours, Robert Underwood Johnson. Tesla's holiday spirit prevailed, and he joined his beloved Johnsons for Christmas dinner, apologizing for being so distant by bringing Mrs. Philipoff an exquisite bouquet of flowers. The celebration of the inauguration of the Niagara Power Station was held at the Ellicott Club in Buffalo in the midst of winter's most dangerous month. Fortunately, the weather was permitting, and 350 of the nation's most prominent businessmen made the January trek. Hosted by Morgan's advance man, Francis Lynn Stetson, a law partner of Grover Cleveland's, the list of attendees included a veritable who's who of commerce. Curiously missing from the event, although invited, were such notables as John Jacob Astor, J. Pierpont Morgan, and Thomas Alva Edison. Mr. Stetson spoke of the pall of smoke hanging over Buffalo, and said that the day should come when power would come from Niagara and not from smoke and steam. The introduction of Nikola Tesla, the greatest electrician on earth, produced a monstrous ovation. The guests sprang to their feet and wildly waved napkins and cheered for the famous scientist. It was 3 or 4 minutes before quiet prevailed. A constellation of psychological peculiarities accompanied the wizard's lecture. He began in a self-deprecating manner. "I have scarcely had courage enough to address an audience on a few unavoidable occasions. Even now, as I speak, the fugitive conceptions will vanish, and I shall experience certain well-known sensations of abandonment, chill, and silence. I can see already your disappointed countenances, and can read in them the painful regret of the mistake of your choice." Why did Tesla poison the well with this dreadful opening? A deep sense of inferiority appears evident, and yet Tesla was also completely aware that this dinner was in his honor, and was therefore the pinnacle of his life to date, and through him an apotheosis for the whole of humanity. Why didn't he simply congratulate himself or accept praise well deserved? We see here the first tangible manifestations of an overpowering feeling of inferiority, a clear-cut, self-destructive element in his nature. The dark legacy of a deep-seated repression flooded through his veins like a hydra about to annihilate. Nevertheless, it was his inventions that would change an entire world. It was the name of Nikola Tesla which appeared a dozen times on the patent plaque of his new system. It was Nikola Tesla who was praised with wild enthusiasm by the corporate and engineering intelligentsia. And it was Nikola Tesla who changed in precise and measurable ways the very direction humanity was taking. This was a moment of anointment. Through his specific action, the evolution of the race and the texture of an entire planet would be permanently changed in a positive way. Yet at this moment of the fulfillment of his greatest wish, a deep neurotic constellation was also triggered. From the psychoanalytic perspective, Tesla could now repay his family for the death of his brother by symbolically bringing the brother back to life, and on the larger scale, give the world a new life, his AC polyphase system. But the shadow had its hold, and he was simply unable to accept the happiness of the moment without throwing a monkey wrench into it. His speech went on. "These remarks, gentlemen, are not made with the selfish desire of winning your kindness and indulgence of my shortcomings, but with the honest intention of offering you an apology for your disappointment. But I am hopeful that in my formless and incomplete statements there may be something of interest benefiting this unique occasion." Tesla's unconscious plan, the heart and soul of his neurosis, was to completely undermine himself by downgrading the Niagara Endeavour. It is possible that Stetson had read the speech on the train ride up to Buffalo and foresaw the tragic consequences, as it appears that he waited for a propitious moment to cut the tail end off. Now that Tesla had arrived, he began to see himself as more than a mere inventor. He was a creator, not of great paintings or of great musical compositions, but of great technologies. Niagara Falls was but a stepping stone to the larger plan. His speech went on to pay homage to the philanthropic spirit of the businessman and the great contribution of the scientist. Tesla also hailed such individuals as arc lighting designer Charles Brush, vacuum tube inventor Philip Lennard, and railroad engine designer Frank Sprague, as well as Wilhelm Röntgen, Lord Rayleigh, Elihu Thompson, Thomas Edison, and George Westinghouse. All of these men, and many more, are untiringly at work investigating new regions and opening up unsuspected and promising fields. Among all these many departments of research, there is one which is of the greatest significance for the comfort and existence of mankind, and that is the electrical transmission of power. We have many a monument of past ages exemplifying the greatness of nations, the power of men, the love of art and religious devotion. But that monument at Niagara has something of its own worthy of our scientific age, a true monument of enlightenment and of peace. It signifies the subjugation of natural forces to the service of man, the discontinuance of barbarous methods, the relieving of millions from want and suffering. Power is our mainstay, the primary source of our many-sided energies. Stetson saw his moment and returned to the stage to whisper in Tesla's ear. "I am just informed," Tesla suddenly announced, "that in 3 minutes we have to leave." "What can I say?" Cries of no. "I can congratulate the courageous pioneers who have embarked in this enterprise and carried it to success. Buffalonians, I would say friends, let me congratulate you on the wonderful expanse of possibilities opened, and let me wish that in no time distant your city will be a worthy neighbor of the great cataract which is one of the great wonders of nature." There was a train to catch. The rest of the speech would be published in the electrical journals. It was a fortuitous break, for here we see a positive statement concerning the stupendous achievement at Niagara, and we also see the seeds of a new vision Tesla was planting for the world. He was not a mechanic, but an artist. Monetary gain was not an end. In fact, the providing of cheap power for the masses was a goal. Businessmen were not greedy capitalists, but noble philanthropists. This was a utopian dream which perhaps one day might come true. And as we shall see, it was also a justification, maybe even a rationalization, for some of the audacious ways Tesla chose to spend the contributions of the financiers who came to support his Promethean campaign. Playing the master game, Tesla was gambling for all the stakes. His goal was no less than the ability to transform himself into a deity. This, as O'Neill writes, was his Superman complex. "We shall not satisfy ourselves simply with improving present-day methods. We have a greater task to fulfill, to evolve means for obtaining energy from stores which are forever inexhaustible, to perfect methods which do not imply consumption and waste of any material whatever. I have examined for a long time the possibilities of operating engines on any point of the earth by the energy of the medium, and I am glad to say that I have devised means which has given me fresh hope that I shall see the fulfillment of one of my fondest dreams, namely, the transmission of power from station to station without the employment of any connecting wire." Tesla had audaciously proclaimed in the written and published part of his speech that this great enterprise which they were about to usher in, and the one we still use a century later, was already obsolete. He had a better plan. There was no need for the millions of telephone poles that were to be erected, no need for the megatons of copper that would have to go into an endless array of interconnected power lines, no need for the enormous production of rubber for insulation, or for the tens of thousands of acres required to support the system, and no need for the workmen who were soon to be hired to maintain the equipment. For all of this, the transmission of electrical power, light, and information could be achieved without wires. No wonder Stetson cut Tesla short. This speech was the pivotal moment in Tesla's career. He set out full force to achieve this end. Nothing but death would stop him in his attempts to realize the dream. 21. Luminaries, 1896-98. A memorable occasion was the first meeting of Tesla and Paderewski, two more intellectual or lovable men I have never known. They were most congenial and became friends at once. On comparing notes, they discovered that they had both been in Strasbourg years before at the same time, 1882, Tesla as an electrical assistant on a small salary, and Paderewski as a student in music. and they laughed heartily at the change of their condition since that time of storm and stress. Robert Underwood Johnson. Tesla travelled back to Manhattan with T.C. Martin, Francis Lynn Stetson, Darius Ogden Mills, and John Hayes Hammond's brother, Richard Hammond, who was considering placing Tesla turbines at a dam in California. A Roentgen symposium was being coordinated by Martin and R.U. Johnson under the auspices of the Century, and Tesla would help in the preparations. But disagreements with Tom Edison, Elihu Thompson, and Mikhail Pupin had peaked, and Tesla declined an invitation to a dinner of all the participants. "I cannot explain, but it is really impossible for me to join the company," he said. Edison was about to join forces with Marconi. Thompson was still pirating Tesla's induction motor, Pupin the Tesla oscillators. Stetson, as Morgan's attorney general, could smooth over the bumps in GE's attempts to lay the groundwork for a pooling of patents with Westinghouse. GE would get the AC polyphase system in exchange for the Vanderpoel trolley patents, but he could never erase the growing vendetta against Tesla by a number of key men in his industry. This was a particularly difficult time for Martin, and so a gap between Martin and Tesla began to form. At the end of January, Tesla sponsored another lavish feast followed by a tour of his lab. He invited John Jacob Astor and his stunning wife, Ava Willing, and Mr. and Mrs. Stanford White. Due to the late hour, Lady Astor was dreadfully disappointed to pass on the electrical pyrotechnics. However, White and company were able to take advantage of the entire affair. "My dear Tesla," wrote White, "I cannot tell you how impressed I was the other night at your laboratory and how delighted I was to be there." Signing the letter, "Affectionately yours," White also congratulated Tesla on his address at Buffalo, which was so full of beautiful thoughts. This was White's second visit to the lab, and his feelings for Tesla continued to grow. March 28, 1896. "Dear Luca, I happen to be free this evening. If you have visitors, ordinary mortals, I will not come. If you have Paderewski, Roentgen, or Mrs. Anthony, I will come. Yours sincerely, TGI." Tesla, great inventor, had met Paderewski for the first time at a dinner at the Johnson Salon in April of 1896. After an invitation from Robert, Tesla wrote back, "Hope that Mr. Paderewski will come." He was referring to Paderewski's trademark, a lush, unbridled mane which flared above his head as he played the piano during his concerts. Referring to this first meeting, Johnson wrote, "Like Tesla, he, Paderewski, has a marvelous mind, which is a storehouse of knowledge on all sorts of topics." Johnson, who had written a poem about the virtuoso, likened Paderewski's music to choiring angels in paradise. Latter-day Prime Minister of Poland, Paderewski was the highest-paid performer of the decade. Richard Watson Gilder, editor-in-chief at the Century, frequently invited, in Paderewski's words, "all the great visiting artists, musicians, distinguished writers, sculptors, painters, and politicians who came to America." A connoisseur of art and of life, Gilder appreciated and recognized at once the unusual in everything, in people as well. Through Gilder, Johnson met many luminaries, and through Johnson, Tesla followed. At the same time, in the spring of 1896, Tesla and the Johnsons were busy reading Rudyard Kipling's recently published Jungle Book. "The stories of Kipling's are charm itself," Tesla wrote Mrs. Philipoff. "I think Rikki Tikki Tavi is the best." 2 days later, a party for Kipling was organized at the Johnson home. "Sorry, I cannot come to dinner," Tesla wrote, "but will show up as soon as possible afterwards." Kipling, who was 30 at the time, had purchased a house from his brother-in-law in Brattleboro, Vermont, where he had written The Jungle Book, and now he had come to New York to help promote it. Much like Twain, Kipling was known as a globetrotter, having visited such places as Ceylon, India, New Zealand, and Australia. After the party and his stay in New York, Kipling travelled to England and then on to South Africa. On the boat trip over, he ran into John Hayes Hammond, and when he reached Cape Town, he talked Cecil Rhodes into giving him a tour of the front lines of the Boer War. Upon his return to New York in early 1899, he spent time with Tesla before another formal dinner in his honour was prepared by the Johnsons. The following letter, although written 3 years later, reflects the kind of friendship the two men shared. Dear Mrs. Philipoff, what is the matter with Inkspiller Kipling? He actually